Ecclesiastes chapter 9. As we continue to make our way through the Bible from Genesis to Revelation, our second time through, and find ourselves here in Ecclesiastes. Solomon is the author of Ecclesiastes, and he is with unlimited resources as the king of Israel. He has given himself into the attempt to find the meaning to life under the sun, under the S-U-N, apart from relationship with God. And he's searched everywhere. He's gone high and low. As we've seen, he's tried to find the meaning to life in education or the accumulation of wisdom or knowledge. And then he gave himself to partying. And then when that wasn't satisfying to him, it was empty and frustrating, which is the theme of the book. He then gave himself to the accumulation of land, to the accumulation of property, building projects, ranching, farming, the gaining of wealth. And then all of that was empty to him in terms of the purpose and the meaning to life. And so he gave himself to just good hard work. He'd immerse himself in the company, you know, and immerse himself in just good, hard, sweaty work and see if he could find fulfillment in that. And that was empty and frustrating. So he dabbled in religion a little bit, and then he gave himself to, you know, selfism and selfishness. And then he thought, I'll abandon myself to children and family. That's what I must be missing. And so he had children like crazy and family like crazy as no one else had before, and still empty and frustrated. So he said, I must be able to find the meaning to life in gaining a reputation, a great reputation in the world. And he found that to be empty also. And so the theme all the way through is he's trying to find the meaning to life under the sun in the context of creation, but not taking into account the creator behind the creation. And over again, he says, life is empty and it's frustrating. And in those first six chapters of the book, he tried to find the meaning to life in all of the places that everyone else told him that he would find the meaning to life. And then in chapter 7, he decides, forget it. He's not impressed with any other man's wisdom or the wisdom of the world, but he's still impressed with his own wisdom. And so he begins to lay out from chapter 7 all the way to the end of the book until the final few verses at the end of the book, he begins to lay out his wisdom, what he thinks. And as we saw last time we were together, it's kind of like he draws us together and says, all right, you know, I haven't discovered the meaning, the ultimate meaning to life, but I've discovered a few things about life that I'd like to share with you. And, you know, you can ask anyone, probably any of us in this room, our opinion on this or that, and we'll be glad to give it to you. You know, we all have a philosophy in life. And so we find ourselves in chapter 9, he's still laying out his philosophy on life, his observations on life. And his observations, some of them are accurate, some of them are not accurate at all, but they constitute his observations, not what's true as it relates to what God has to say, but God records it because it's a part of his search. Now, in chapter 7 to the end of the book, one of the characteristics of the book is his continual use of the word good and better. And we dealt with this in depth last time, but I want to talk about it for another moment by way of introduction tonight. Because there is a multitude of people who are being taken further and further and further away from a relationship with God, which they've been created for, because they have been deceived by other people and by religious systems and philosophical systems that pull them away from God. But there are just as many people who are pulled away from a relationship with God, again, the very thing that they've been created for, not by the deceptiveness of other men, but by self-deception, their own ideas, their own idea that God somehow grades on a curve. And if I'm just good compared to everyone else, that will make me acceptable to God. Or if I am just better than everyone else, that will make me acceptable to God. And that's the philosophy that he's working under. And it's a, you know, it is the foundation of most philosophy of men, that if there is a God, he grades on a curve, just do better than the masses, and you should do all right. Or if you don't, you'll have plenty of company, that kind of a thing. And so this is what he's operating in. Now, in chapter 9, we begin, and fascinating what he cannot shake himself loose from. Now, some of you may be absolutely bored to tears by Ecclesiastes at this particular point. I'm not. I love it. I could finish this book and start it over again. I love this man's search. He says, "For I considered all this in my heart," all of these, you know, his philosophy that he's been laying out like, you know, Pa Kettle. "For I considered all this in my heart so that I could declare it all, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. People know neither love nor hatred by anything that is before them. Everything occurs alike to all." And so he talks about what happens to everyone, and he returns to the theme of death. He cannot get away from death. Can't get away from it. And there is within man a fear of death, a consciousness that death is an enemy that needs to be conquered. And he can't get away from this thing, and he doesn't, in his own personal philosophy, he doesn't have an answer for death. And that's something that you have to answer in your own personal philosophy if you're going to reject God. Why do we die? The Bible is very, very clear. Paul, bringing it out in the book of Romans, he said, "Therefore, just as through one man's sin entered the world, and death through sin, and thus death spread to all men because all sinned." The reason that people die is because of the fall of man, because of sin introduced into mankind by Adam and Eve and their act of disobedience. He said one occurrence event happens to the righteous and to the wicked. Everybody dies. To the good, the clean, and then the rascals, the unclean. To him who sacrifices, I mean, he's a good church-going guy, and to him who never goes to church, never sacrifices. As is the good, so is the sinner. They both die. And he who takes an oath, as he who fears an oath. And this is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that one thing happens to all. Truly the hearts of men, of the sons of men, are full of evil. Madness is in their hearts while they live, and after that they go to the dead. In other words, they all die. There's something about the way that man, as he witnessed how mankind died, that seemed absolutely unfair to him, and he couldn't find an answer to it in his mind. You would think that the good people, the nice people, the righteous people, the moral people, that they would live longer lives than the wicked, and that the wicked would always die young. But he says as he looks at it, he sees that, you know, there are just as many righteous dying at a young age as the wicked are dying, just as many wicked growing old as righteous are growing old. He thought there should be a pattern. There ought to be a pattern. There ought to be something that we can look at and say, if I always do this, it will always translate into this as it relates to death or long life or the shortness of life. But he says there is no pattern. There's no pattern to it. And it really, really troubled him. He said, but for him who is joined to all the living, there is hope. So as long as a person is alive, there's hope. For a living dog, and a dog was a lowly esteemed animal in the Middle East in those days. We have them as pets and we adore them. But in those days, a dog was just a very base animal in their minds. And so he said, but for him who is joined to all of the living, as long as you're alive, there's hope. But for a living dog is better than a dead lion. And so you just got this mangy mutt of a dog, and you got this, you know, lion over here. It's dead. I mean, king of beasts, you know, king of the jungle right there. And he's dead. And somebody came up to you and said, if I was going to put you in one of those two bodies, which one would you choose? I'll take the little mixed, terrier, German shepherd, dachshund, doesn't matter how ugly that thing is. You're going to choose it. Why? Because it has life. And so there's a recognition that as long as there's life, There's still some hope. And there is hope as long as there's life. And the spiritual application is as long as I have life, I still have opportunity to choose the living hope that God has provided for us in His Son, the Lord Jesus. But once I enter into the place of death, now there's no ability to choose. And so he says, this, what's better, this ugly little dog or a lion? Well, the dog is as long as it's alive. What's better, to work at a carnival and work it there at the dime toss, winning, you know, the ashtray thing there, or to be Elvis at this point? Give me my apron. I'm going to work at the dime toss. There's, you know, there's still some hope there. Elvis doesn't have any. Oh, I know some of you still have some hope that he's somewhere. Where's Dave? Dave right there. So it's a sad thing. He looks. Death keeps facing it. For the living know that they will die. And so here we are, we're alive, and we recognize one day I'm going to die. Oh man, could there be anything worse than realizing that one day I'm going to die? Yeah, being dead, he says here. But the dead know nothing. They don't know anything, but they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten, and their love, their hatred, and their envy have now perished. In other words, they don't have the capacity to experience these things anymore. Nevermore will they have a share in anything that is done under the sun. Now, he's speaking for himself. This is not what God says, because man doesn't cease to exist at the point that he dies. But he's laying out his personal philosophy. And so, what's the conclusion that he comes to? Enjoy life. You know, have as much fun as you can before you die. He said, go eat your bread with joy. Eat as much as you can. All right. And drink with your wine with a merry heart. Drink as much as you can. For God has already accepted your works. It's okay with God. Now, it's interesting here. He's trying to find the meaning of life under the sun, outside of the context of God. But like so many people like him, when it's handy to bring God up, he brings them up. So it's amazing how you talk with atheists and they bring up God when it's handy. And so he says, God's already accepted your works. It's all okay with him, Solomon says. Let your garments always be white. In other words, wear the nicest clothes, wear bright clothes. I mean, you only got so many years to wear them. And let your head lack no oil. Get some good cologne. Don't buy that cheap stuff anymore. Get yourself some, you know, real good stuff. Some of that Michael Jordan stuff. And he's just saying, have some fun. You know, you're going to die. Have some fun. And so he has no answer for death. So that's all that he can say. So go see as many movies as you can and buy as many CDs as you can and go to as many amusement parks as you can and stuff. Because you're going to be dead someday. Live joyfully. He says, and don't forget, enjoy your wife, all the satisfaction that comes there. Live joyfully with a wife whom you love all the days of your vain life, which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. And then in verse 10, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all of your might, for there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. It's like, can I get off your lap now? I don't think I want to hear anymore. Could we break for refreshments or something here? You know, and so he's saying, work hard. Give yourself to just good, hard work, you know, because someday you're going to be dead and you're going to wish you could work hard, you know, that kind of thing. So next time you're sweating out in the field or whatever you're doing, it could be worse. You could be dead and not able to do it, is what he's saying. Verse 11. I returned and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift. You'd think the swift would always win. Nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding. He said, I noticed that the men of understanding, the wise men, it's not always recompensed with riches or with bread. He said, I've seen wise men starve on this earth. And so, again, there's this idea, it doesn't add up. I look at mankind and I look at how it goes and I see the wise man starved to death and I see the fool over here eat until he can't eat anymore, until he heads to the vomitorium. And so he can't get it to add up. And that's the thing, is you look at life and you'd think it would always, again, as we saw earlier, that there would be this pattern, that there would be this rule, but the world is in chaos. It defies categorization. Why? Because the world has fallen. the world has fallen. That's the only explanation for the world as we see it, is that it is fallen. He says, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to all of them. He says, you do much better to just be lucky in this world than to be skilled. You know, just be at the right place at the right time. And sometimes that you look at life and it seems that way, doesn't it? For man does not know, also does not know his time, like fish taken in a cruel net, like birds caught in a snare, so the sons of men are snared in an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. And so he can't get a grasp on any of the, again, the pattern of things. Now he begins to talk about how wisdom is better than strength in this world, but it's rarely rewarded. And it's interesting that it's true. This wisdom I have also seen under the sun, and it seemed great to me. There was a little city with a few men in it, and a great king came up against it to battle them, besieged it, and built great snares around it. Now there was found in this little city a poor wise man, and he, by his wisdom, delivered the city, had the plan for delivering the city. Yet no one remembered that same poor man. And then I said, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, the poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. Words of the wise spoken quietly should be heard, rather than the shout of a ruler of fools. But the wise man is rarely listened to in this world. The shouting fool, most often, is the one that's listened to. Wisdom is better than weapons of war, but one sinner destroys much good. And so he looks at wisdom, and he says, wisdom is greater than anything else in this world, but so often it's only valued at the time of crisis. And then once man gets out of the bind that he's in, then he completely forgets wisdom, and especially completely forgets God's wisdom. So here's a man who saves an entire city, but there's no gratitude for it. And so amazing how this world will turn to true wisdom only in order to save its neck. And as soon as its neck is saved, boom, it forgets it so quickly. Now, in chapter 10, he heads into some assorted proverbs, and he begins by giving some proverbs on folly or foolishness. He said, and this verse has always intrigued me. He said, dead flies, isn't that picture this? Dead flies putrefy the perfumer's ointment. And I think in the Old King James it says, dead flies in the apothecary. So you got dead flies in your cold cream, or, you know, your whatever kind of a gel or whatever it might be there for fragrant oil that's there. So you got these dead flies, and they ruin. They just make it stink. They cause it to give off a foul odor. And so does a little folly to one respected for wisdom and honor. Little tiny fly. You can have this whole big vat of you know, scented ointment and fragrant and valuable and wonderful. All you have to do is just have one fly die in it. And be in there a couple weeks. In a nice hot summer season here in Modesto. And you open that up, and what woman in the world is going to use that? You're going to have to buy her more ointment. She's not going to use that. Why? Because that one little tiny fly will ruin the whole jar of ointment. In the same way, for a man who is called to a position of honor and a position of respect, it's amazing how just one little small thing, or one little what we would call a character flaw, can take the focus of everyone off of, you know, all of the other fragrance that's in the life, and all you notice is the stink that comes out of that one area of life. And so it's the little things that can so often make or break our witness as Christians. And we all have a little thing. We all have a potential little fly that, if left alone, can really cause a stink in our life. And so to be careful of that so that it doesn't ruin our effectiveness. He says in verse 2, a wise man's heart is at his right hand, but a fool's heart at his left. And so the right hand was always superior to the left in that culture and in that day. And so the right hand was considered to be more active and more skillful. The left hand was a slow hand. It was an awkward hand for most people. And so the wise man is the man that allows his heart to be guided by his right hand, by the superior things in life, while the fool allows his life to be guided by the inferior things or his left hand. We have to be careful what we allow to guide our lives. Verse 3, even when a fool walks along the way, doesn't even open his mouth, he lacks wisdom, and he shows everyone that he's a fool. In other words, if a person's a fool, it can't be kept a secret. It's going to come out even when they walk. Verse 4, don't shout out any names. Verse 4 here. He talks about how to conduct ourselves in a wise fashion under foolish leaders or bosses or rulers. He said, if the spirit of the ruler rises against you, he gets mad at you, don't leave your post, for conciliation pacifies great offenses. Don't quit every time he gets upset. Just stay where you are. He'll calm down. That's what Solomon is saying. He's a king. He'd seen a lot of it in that ruler. He said, there's an evil that I have seen under the sun as an error proceeding from the ruler. Folly is set in great dignity while the rich sit in a lowly place. And what he's saying is, one of the things you have to accept in life is that promotion in this world is utterly illogical at times. You'll see the foolish person exalted and the rich man and the wise man left in the base place within the company or within, you know, the way that the world operates. And when that happens to you, and it will happen to you as a Christian, it'll happen to many of us in this room, we must understand that is not a reflection upon you, but it is a reflection upon the foolishness of the leader. Now, you don't get proud over that, but it helps you to accept that that's just the way that it is so often. He said in verse 7, I have seen servants on horses, in other words, given positions of high positions, while princes walk on the ground like servants. And so he's saying, don't expect, you know, to be fairly treated in this world. The princes are often treated very, very poorly in this world. But again, it's not a reflection of you. It's a reflection of the one who makes those decisions. Now he talks about the importance of wisdom, even in hard work. Hard work is important. But even in hard work, there's got to be some wisdom involved in it. He who digs a pit will fall into it. You know, here you can be a Brutus, big old muscles and everything. You can, you know, have shovel, will travel. You can dig a pit. I mean, just a trench as far as can be. But if you're not smart enough to remember where you dug it, you're going to fall into it. So there needs to be that brute strength, but there needs to be, you know, wisdom about, you know, how to handle that kind of a thing. He says, whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. So if you're in construction, the idea is they worked with stone in that part of the world, and you're enlarging your house a little bit, adding onto a room. Hey, you got the big muscles and everything to move the stones and break down the wall, but don't forget that snakes like cool, dark places, you know, to rest in, and so don't be reaching in there, pulling out stones without checking for serpents also. Use some wisdom. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them. In other words, it takes strength to quarry them. But if you don't do it right, you're going to mess your back up. And he who splits wood may be endangered by it. This last time that we were in India, it was a fascinating thing to watch. We watched this guy splitting kindling for a fire. And I don't know if it was a morning fire or if it was an evening fire. But he had the kindling and he had this axe. And the sticks were probably no thicker than that and maybe about this long. And he had them right there, and he was holding it with his big toe. And I mean, just winding up back here, coming down on that thing there. You know, and you could only watch a few whacks like that. He had all of his toes. I checked that. I checked on all of his toes, you know. But no steel-toed boots or anything like that. And he just whacking away at that thing. And every time I thought he was going to lose that big toe, and then we'd have really had a picture. But there has to be wisdom. And obviously he had the wisdom, you know, on how to deal with that. But you have to be careful of that. Here's a very famous proverb out of Ecclesiastes. If the axe is dull, and if you've ever tried to chop something down with a dull axe, you can relate to this. And one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength. So if you've ever used a tool that's gotten dull on you, you say, oh, I'll sharpen on some other day, someday, 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 and finally you just can't use it anymore. You go and sharpen it, and you go, why didn't I do this 10 years ago? You know, kind of a thing. And he said, but wisdom brings success. So the wisdom of staying sharp. And there's a lot to be said about that spiritually, too. I think it was Jesus would take the disciples. At times he'd take them away. And sometimes he'll kind of take us away, you know, just to be with him for a while, or he'll take us away out of the everyday of life, maybe on a weekend or a vacation or whatever, and there can be a sharpening that takes place there. A lot of times, you know, sometimes when you, like if you're preparing a Bible study or something, you're just looking at it, and it's just not breaking, you know, it's not breaking there. And it's not a problem with the Bible, and it's not a problem with the Spirit, and you just go and you take a walk. Or you go, you know, trim a hedge or something like that. And then while you're doing it, all of a sudden, boom, the thing breaks right there. You know, that's what he's saying there, you know. And it can just be that sharpening, that just getting away sharpens you a little bit to allow that to happen. He said a serpent, and now he's going to talk about his thoughts on people who talk too much. He said a serpent may bite when it is not charmed, and a babbler is no different. In other words, sometimes you get a talker, and man, they're saying everything to you, and they're just cutting everyone down, and they're lambasting everyone, and you think, boy, you're really something, because they feel so privileged, you know, you're privileged that they'd share all these things with you and all. And Solomon is saying, just wait, and there'll come a day when they won't be so charmed by you, and then you'll be on the menu in terms of what's being discussed and how true that is. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool shall swallow him up. In other words, that kind of a person ends up destroying themselves. They undo their own credibility, and they end up swallowing themselves. It's a sad picture when you swallow yourself up with your own mouth. The words of his mouth begin with foolishness, talking about the fool, and the end of his talk is raving madness. In other words, there's a type of person that the longer they talk, the weirder it gets. And you ever talk with someone and it's bizarre when it begins, but you keep listening because you hope it's going to turn around, because it can't get worse. So he's going to turn around, he's going to redeem this thing, it's going to be all right by the time he gets done. And he doesn't. He just keeps going, and it just gets worse and worse. And he didn't think it could get worse. He didn't think it could get worse than it was when it began, and yet it does. And so there's, you know, that type of person, the longer they talk, the worse it gets. A fool also multiplies words, and no man knows what is to be. Who can tell him what will be after him? The labor of fools wearies them, for they do not even know how to go to the city. And so here in verses 14 and 15, it's talking about the person that goes on and on and on and on and on, when it's apparent to everyone listening that they don't have the slightest idea what in the world that they're talking about. And so in verse 14 he says, this guy just talks and talks, he doesn't even know the future, and yet he's an expert on everything. And I like in verse 15, he says he doesn't even know how to go to the city. But boy, he'll tell you what the nation, you know, the world, nations of the world ought to do politically and in terms of weaponry and agriculturally and architecturally and all these things. And I mean, he can talk about all of those things. And then you say, by the way, you've grown up in Modesto, haven't you? Yeah, I have. Could you tell me where McHenry is? McHenry, where in the world is McHenry? You know, he knows all of this. Expert on everything, but he doesn't know how to balance a checkbook. And doesn't know how to tie his shoes or match his socks. And so Solomon, apparently this troubled him, because he must have had some laborers that worked for him that were in this category. They would put him in the farthest reaches of the kingdom. Now, in verse 16, he talks about rulers, foolish rulers and wise rulers. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child, when your rulers are immature and your princes feast in the morning. They're partying before they've done any work. That's not a good sign. That's not a good sign. And so he says in verse 17, blessed are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobles. He's been prepared to lead, and your princes feast at the proper time after they've worked hard all day, and they feast for the purpose of strength and not to get drunk. Because of laziness, the building decays, and through idleness of hands, the house leaks. And so whether it's a roof or whether it's a building or whether it's a government or whether it's a life, ultimately it'll collapse if there isn't diligent maintenance given to that life or to that building. A feast is made for laughter, verse 19, and wine makes merry, but money answers everything. This talks about the leader who loves to be in a position of leadership because it's an opportunity to become rich off of it. And isn't it heartbreaking to pick up the newspaper every single day and see vast sections of the world that are just being pillaged by their own rulers? I mean, hard to believe that some nations strip down to where there isn't even bark on the trees, and yet they got $10 billion into Swiss bank accounts. I mean, I don't know. Hopefully God will deal with these things. It's a sad thing, and yet it's always gone on in man's history, that selfishness. Verse 20, do not curse the king even in your thought. One of the things that can be a tendency when the rulers are bad like that is to curse the king. He says, don't do it even in your thoughts. Do not curse the rich even in your bedroom, for a bird of the air may carry your voice, and the bird in flight may tell the matter. In other words, he's saying, assume that everything that you say about another person will be told that person. Just assume that. I mean, boy, wouldn't that change an awful lot of content, wouldn't it? But that's a very, very healthy thing to realize, is to understand that everything I say is probably going to reach the ears of the person that I'm saying it about. You can only hope that it's halfway accurate by the time it reaches there. Chapter 11, again, assorted Proverbs. He says, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. What he's probably talking about here is maybe the Nile River or another river, where you take your rice seed and there would be the muddy banks, and you would throw your seed out into the mud there, and then, you know, it would germinate and all, and then ultimately become a rice crop for you. In other words, be generous. He's commending generosity. Be generous in your seed. It's the only way that more can come back to you. So he's commending generosity. And I love this. This was a very special verse to G. Campbell Morgan. I was reading a biography that his daughter-in-law wrote concerning him. And late in his life, he was a very elderly man and became very weak following World War II, and he stayed in London through all of the Blitzkrieg and all of that was going on. And one of the things that verses that this came to him late in his life, and he talked about how he had, you know, cast his bread, as it says in the Old King James, cast his bread out in the water, and it returned to him. How many men and women that had been impacted by his ministry through the years now came and helped him at a time where he needed help? And so it's a beautiful passage. And so that generosity, it returned back to him. Give a serving, Solomon says, to seven and also to eight, for you do not know what evil will be on the earth. And so again, the commendation of generosity. In other words, if you have seven neighbors, be generous with them. And then, better yet, be generous to eight of them. And the reason is if calamity comes into the land and they owe you something, then, you know, they'll help you out. One of the things that people do today as they invest is they'll diversify in their investments because there's safety there. We would say, don't put all of your eggs in one basket. And so when people are involved in the stock market, They won't typically plunk it all in one stock. They'll diversify it. They'll have it in several places so that if one goes down, maybe a couple of others will go up. Well, he's saying the same thing as it relates to generosity. Be generous with people. And then if you go down or you hit difficulty, then maybe they'll be generous with you. Now, there's some people carry this over into all kinds of different areas in life. I have a note here that Kenny Moore wrote to my daughter and John with his Christmas gift, or his gift, their wedding gift, that is just, this verse was probably on our mind. I thought it was very amusing. Let me read it to you. He said, "Dear John and Morgan Kaler, after annoying everyone at Target while searching for your gift, I decided to give you the gift that says I love you the most, cash." He said, "Don't think that because I'm giving you $20 that I expect anything in return. What's money? In fact, I almost forgot I even gave you $20 until I saw it written on the card earlier. I mean, come on. $20 isn't a small amount or anything. It actually takes me quite a while to make it. I bet Pacific Bell would be mad if they knew I gave away so much money when I owe them over $50, but I'm not... But I'm not going to tell." He said, "Hey, maybe if I'm ever in need and you have an extra 20 on you, maybe you could give it to me." He said, "I don't know. It's your money now. I want you to forget that I even gave it to you after you read this." He says, "Anyway, I've got to go. I have to go make another $20 so that I can eat tonight and so that my sick mother can eat too." He said, "Anyways, I love you both very much, and I can't wait till the three of us take off for the honeymoon." God bless you both, Kenny Moore. He said, "P.S., have fun spending the $20. I know I would have." I would not do that to anyone but Kenny Moore. So, he's been listening to Grandpa Solomon, apparently, here, and, you know, it could be a gift, but it could be a hedge on a bad time in the future, you know, so. Verse 3, he said, "If the clouds are full of rain, they empty themselves on the earth." What's he saying there? What he's saying is, stuff just happens in life. He said, "And if a tree falls to the south or the north, in the place where the tree falls, there it shall lie." In other words, there's just a whole bunch of stuff in life that you and I can't control. You can't control when it rains or when it doesn't rain, or if it's going to rain or if it isn't going to rain, where it's going to rain, it's outside of our control. We have no control over where these trees fall over in a storm. Life just comes, and it comes at us, and life just happens as it comes at us. And so, you know, he's talking about this whole theme. And the point is, as he goes on into verse 4, he says, "He who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap." In other words, he says, life just happens. You can't control it. But don't let that keep you from working. And don't let that keep you from doing what you need to do in life. And so there's a great tendency, isn't there, to overanalyze things to the point of paralysis so that we don't end up doing anything. And he's saying to the farmer, you don't know where the trees are going to fall. You don't know when it's going to rain, or if it's not going to rain, you don't know anything about that. The only thing you have control over is whether you're going to cast that seed or not. You cast it. You do what you can do, and then don't worry about what you can't control. And so as that warning of becoming too cautious, waiting until conditions are perfect, and then you never end up sowing the seed. And so you can't reap where you haven't sown, Solomon is saying. So just sow and keep on sowing. Application related to the gospel and the word of God. There's so much that we can't control. We can't control the birds that may come in and pluck that gospel out of a person's heart that we've shared with. We can't control that their heart may be, you know, filled with thorns and thistles, deceitfulness of riches and the cares of this. There's so much that we can't control. But he just says, don't overanalyze the whole thing. Just keep casting out the seed. Just keep, you know, working at it. Don't overthink it. Just keep spreading it and spreading it and spreading it and spreading it. He says in verse 5, as you do not know what is the way of the wind. We don't know, you know, where the wind comes from or the cycles of it, most of us, or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child. So you do not know the works of God who makes all things. And so he's saying we don't know where the wind comes from and we don't know how a child is formed, but that shouldn't stop us from enjoying the wind and that shouldn't stop us from having children. And so I don't have to know everything to be productive is what he's saying. And so you do not know the works of God and who makes all things. Verse 6, in the morning, sow your seed. And in the evening, don't withhold your hand. Do the same thing again. And for you do not know which will prosper. You don't know if that crop's going to come out of the morning or the evening sowing. So sow at both times, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good. And so he's saying, don't be superstitious. Don't overthink it. Just work hard. And sometimes, you know, sometimes as Christians, you can get paralyzed with analysis and paralyzed with a spiritual superstition. You come to the church and you park your car out there and you know that God has a will for your life and you know you're coming in here for the Bible study, but which door does He want you to enter in through? Is that front door? The perfect will or the permissive will? Or is the fellowship hall door, is that the perfect will or the permissive will? Will I miss a blessing if I go in this door that could be waiting for me at the other door or someone that I'm supposed to share with? And I mean, pretty soon it's like, you know, spiritually, it's just, you know, do what we're supposed to do, work hard at it, and then, you know, trust the Lord related to these other things. Truly, the light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to behold the sun. And he's talking about youth now. And I remember one time, and the blessings of youth, and one of the great blessings of youth is that light looks like light to you. To those of us who are getting older, light is a relative thing to us. I remember when I was growing up, I'd do a lot of reading on my bed. And my mom would come in, and she'd turn the light on. Turn that light on, you're going to ruin your eyes. She didn't talk like that, but that's what it sounded like a lot of times. But she was always coming in and telling us to turn the light on because we're going to ruin our eyes. Well, now that I'm her age, you know, at that time, I realize the problem wasn't with the light, the problem was with her eyes. The room seemed dark to her, but it was perfectly fine for my eyes. I could read and see, you know, clearly. So he's talking about here, light is sweet. You whippersnappers, you enjoy it. Light is sweet, and it is pleasant for the eyes to behold the sun. For if a man lives many years and rejoices in them all, let him remember the days of darkness. He's saying to the, giving some, you know, telling the youth how to wisely use their youth. You know, use it properly and remember that the days of darkness are coming. You're going to die, for they will be many in the grave, and all that is coming is vanity. So he wasn't too perky there. But in verse 9, he begins to talk about he's talking to youth, and he's telling youth how to use their youth, the wise use of youth. He says, rejoice, O young man, in your youth. And I would say to younger people in this room, without pointing you out or without looking at you. You just disgust me. But Youth is a gift. And as somebody said, it's so sad that it's wasted on the young. And so often, it won't be till later that you realize what a gift it was. What it means to eat without feeling your teeth. You know, what it means to not have glasses and all of these hearing aids and all of these different kinds of things that can happen. And I'll tell you, this is good that Solomon does this. And I think the younger generation, by and large, not exclusively, doesn't have enough input from older people. And Solomon is probably an older man by the time he writes this, and he's telling you, appreciate your youth. Appreciate the gift that it is. You'll never have more energy than you have now. You'll never have greater strength than you have now. The vision that you have, spiritual vision, these kinds of things, zeal for the Lord, these things about youth. And so recognize that it's a gift and appreciate it, and above all, protect those things. And he says, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes. Use your eyes for the things of the Lord. Use your life for the things of the Lord. And know that for all these, God will bring you into judgment. In other words, with old age. Old age is coming. And therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity. And surely they are apart from the Lord. But not in the Lord. A tremendous thing. I think one of the greatest testimonies that a person can ever give to any body of believers is that they got saved early in life, gave their life to the Lord, and they served Him from their youth on. And that's quite a testimony to survive the church. But that's a wonderful testimony. And not enough of those. There are plenty of the other ones. And many of us in this room that could give the other ones, they would say with Solomon, use your youth for the Lord and the things of the Lord. It's interesting that I heard a man who is head of one of the largest mission organizations in the world speak. And he was speaking to a very large group of Christians. And he said, do you know what the greatest hindrance to youth becoming involved in missions today? And then he told them, Christian parents, who take that zeal that their children have for the Lord and the vision that God has given them as great as He has given Joseph, that vision for their life, the desires for their life, and then they say, take it but you know, don't go out and do that. Get your, you know, share of the American dream. Get yourself settled. Get yourself, you know, financially set and all of those things, and then go out and do it, or then support others who will go out and do it. And then, unfortunately, by the time they get themselves in that place, so often they're a 30 or a 35-year-old sitting in church falling asleep at every service. And so often longing that if they had just listened to what God had put on their heart and headed out where they were supposed to head out. And Solomon tells you, your youth is a gift. It's a great gift. And to use it for the things of the Lord, you won't regret it. Chapter 12, he said, remember now your Creator in the days of your youth. And so use your youth to grow in your relationship with the Lord, because you need it not only to serve the Lord in your youth, but also in preparation for the day when you'll be older. And you'll want that close walk with the Lord when the body begins to break down. He said, before the difficult days come and the years draw near when you say, I have no pleasure in them. Now he's talking from a secular vantage point, and he's talking about old age where you look at that, you know, time in life and you just go, I don't have any pleasure in this season in life. But this is apart from the Lord. Sometimes it can be the aches and pains of age and these different kinds of things. A lot of it's chronic and a lot of it's very, very difficult. But I tell you, with the Lord, there's that thankfulness that we've gotten as old as we've gotten, that we've lived as long as we've lived, that we have Him to talk to in the midst of it. And there's always that confidence of just knowing that the reason I am still here is that there are eternal purposes that He wants to work in my life and He wants to work through my life. And that's very, very encouraging, and I need to know that. And so there is, he makes it, you know, darker than it seems. Every season in life has its blessings in the Lord. And but again, he's probably an old man while he writes this, and he gives one of the greatest descriptions of old age in the whole Bible. Verse 2, while the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are not darkened, he says, you know, in other words, while you can still enjoy a sunset and looking at the stars, and you don't have to say, what stars? Let me go get my glasses. And the clouds do not return after the rain. In other words, when life becomes just one endless storm after another. And then here as he describes old age, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble. The keepers of the house, he's describing the arms and the legs. And they're just that time in life where you get, and they don't stay so stable. And they just start to shake no matter what you can do. There's no stopping it. He says, and the strong men bow down. And he's talking about the shoulders, you know, it just starts to creep a little bit, you know, as you get older and those, you know, and it's hard to believe. Sometimes you look at an older person and it's hard to believe that they were once just like you. And they had the big biceps and the whole thing and they would pin you to the wall anytime they wanted to, you know, kind of a thing. But now the strong men, those big shoulders, you know, now they're starting to bow over. When the grinders cease, the teeth, because they are few. Now he's talking about a day when there were no dentures or anything like that. You lost your teeth. And he said, and those that look through the windows grow dim, talking about the eyes getting bad and starting to grow dim. Again, in that day, there are no glasses. So you begin to lose your eyesight. Some of you have had glasses all of your life. Imagine no glasses. What life would have been for you. Verse 4, he talks about when the doors are shut in the streets and the sound of grinding is low. In other words, when the ears can't hear what's going on outside like they used to. And then the women grinding outside, you used to be able to hear them and all the work, and now it's all like they've turned the volume down on you. Now, we have a Cocker Spaniel at home, Abby, and Abby has gone stone deaf in the last year. And she's an older gal now. But we could march a brass band right by her doghouse. She wouldn't know that it was in the yard. Wouldn't know at all. I mean, her hearing's gone. We're too cheap to buy her hearing aids. So it's just the way it is for a dog. And so, but we take care of her special in other ways. But you know, the hearing, it just goes. He says, it describes the old age as when one rises up at the sound of a bird. It's amazing how you can lose your hearing and yet you can hear the first bird that chirps in the morning and it wakes you up. You can't go back to sleep. And typically, the older you get, the more light you sleep and the harder it is to sleep all the way through, or sleep as long as you like to at night. And all of the daughters of music are brought low. In other words, you can't sing anymore. He said also, when they're afraid of height, that's one of the things about growing older, heights become a little more uncertain for us. And the terrors of the way, in other words, there's just that increasing sense of vulnerability the older you get. I'm heading out and I'm vulnerable, not like I was when I was 25, 35 or 45 or even 55 and all. I'm more vulnerable, and there's a sense of that, of the tears in the way. When the almond tree blossoms, and this is talking about the hair, And it's talking about the white blossoms that we see in the almond orchards, you know. You get the white blossoms, and so it's talking about the white hair. But then what happens to those white blossoms? They go, don't they? You turn around and go, what happened to all the white blossoms? Well, what happened to all the hair? It's all gone, it happens. And it's a time in life when the grasshopper is a burden. The grasshopper is a burden. And, it's sad when a grasshopper becomes a burden. Now, we don't really know what he's saying here. Could be that you're walking down the sidewalk and then there's a grasshopper. Ooh. What do we do now? You know, there'd be that indecision over that. Or it could be talking about that grasshopper. There it is. It's in your house. Now you got to catch it. Hey, they're not easy to catch when you're 20. You know, and you're 80, 85, and whatever it might be. Grasshopper is big trouble in a house. Big trouble, is what he's saying here. And it can be. He says, and desire fails, the appetite, the sexual drive. And for man goes to his eternal home, to the grave, and the mourners go about in the streets. And so, interesting description of old age. But again, no hope to move on to the, you know, temple that God has created for us, the new body. He says in verse 6, remember your Creator, and then notice that next word, before. Remember your Creator before death comes, and he describes death in four different ways. Before the silver cord is loosed, in other words, the spirits released from the body is what it's talking about, or the pitcher shattered, or the golden bowl is broken, in other words, the cranial cavity ceases at the time of death, or the pitcher shattered at the fountain, speaking of the heart stops, or the wheel broken at the well, again, the heart stopping. So he says, remember the Lord before you face that. Have a relationship with him before you face death. For sure have a relationship with him before you head into death. And then the dust will return to the earth as it was, speaking of the human body, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. And now, here he is, he's studied all of man's philosophies, all of man's ideas. He's been jabbering on through all of these chapters about his own philosophy of life. And finally, it's almost like in mid-sentence, he says, vanity of vanities, or emptiness, emptiness of emptiness, says the preacher, all is vanity, all is emptiness. It's like he interrupts himself. It's like earlier, he's listening to all of the wisdom of the world, and there just came a point where he just says in his mind, ah, shut up. And then there comes a point where he's just going on and on and on and on, and then finally it's almost like he says to himself, ah, shut up. What do you know? Now, nobody else should say that to another person, but I've said that to myself. I've said that to myself, and I'm free to do that. Don't you do that to me. The Lord's still working in my life. I don't know if I could handle it at this point, maybe in my new body. But there is that deal where you just look and you just go, what do you know? What do you know in life? Look at you. You know, and it's amazing so often as you look at people that you're sharing with and you're witnessing to as it relates to the gospel and everything. And they reject God. They reject his ways. They reject his wisdom. They're still convinced that their wisdom is so impressive. And you look at their life and you go, it's a shambles. It's a disaster by any standard. How can you still be impressed with what you think when what you think produces that? But there just comes that point, though, where you just get sick of yourself. And sick of, you know, what you think and what you say, and you're tired and no longer impressed with it. And now all of a sudden, now I'm ready for the real truth of what life is all about. And so he says it's all emptiness. Solomon, shut up. Now don't say that in front of the kids. This is why we only allow adults in the sanctuary. And moreover, because the preacher was wise, he still taught the people knowledge. Yes, he pondered and sought out and set in order many proverbs. And so now he's talking about the method that he used to make his point. The preacher sought to find acceptable words or delightful words. And what was written was upright words of truth. The words of the wise are like goads. And so he's talking about the whole form that the letter took. And it's a beautiful book. It's a poetic book. It's outstanding.
the way the whole thing is laid out. I mean, the individual wisdom in it, in spots isn't, you know, God's wisdom on the thing, but the whole progression, the whole thing is, it's a beautiful thing. It's orderly. It's delightfully arranged. And he said, the words of the wise, speaking of himself and putting this together, are like goads. And a goad was just a stick that was sharp on one end, and it was used for directing herds in a particular direction. In other words, he said, this whole letter is written to drive every reader to one point. He's getting to that. He said, the words of scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. And he recognized that this book had been given to him inspired by the Lord himself. And he said, and furthermore, my son, be admonished by these, of making many books there is no end, and much study is wearisome to the flesh. In other words, what he's saying is, I could go on and on and on and on, but let's get to the point. And he said, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. No more of man's wisdom, no more of my wisdom. Let's get to the conclusion of the whole matter. And he says, here is the conclusion. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether it is good or whether it is evil. And now all of a sudden, God just blooms right onto the scene. Repeats his name twice, doesn't he? There in verses 13 and 14. And now all of a sudden, everything makes sense once the Creator is brought into the context of life. Why? Again, because we have been made for relationship with Him. And until we're engaged in that relationship, everything in life at best is going to be emptiness, and it's going to be frustration. Now, I think it's interesting that Solomon, as he lays out here the conclusion of the whole matter in verse 13, he says the conclusion is to fear God, to fear God, just to love God, and to keep His commandments. Now, when they came to Jesus one day, they said to Jesus, what must we do to do, you know, the works of God? And Jesus answered and said to them, this is the work of God, that you believe in Him whom He sent. And so, how can I fear God? How can I keep His commandments? By trusting in His Son, trusting in Jesus, whom He has sent to provide salvation for us and a way of fellowship and relationship with God. And so that reverence for God, the fear of God, begins by accepting His salvation that He's provided through His Son. And then, having accepted that salvation, now I respond to that salvation by obeying His commandments. And what are His commandments? Love God with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourself. The whole thing to life is to love God in a personal relationship with Him, and then to serve Him by loving our neighbor the way we already love ourselves, as Jesus would say later in the Gospels. And so that's the conclusion. That's where life is found. That's where the meaning of life is found, in that relationship.